One week ago, in the early morning, those living in southern Israel experienced a horrific event. A reported 1,500 Hamas militants armed with AK-47s and grenade launchers and probably other weapons stormed through the Israeli towns and going into the out of the Palestinian territory of the Gaza Strip. Now, this was combined as well with thousands and thousands of rockets being fired into Israel from the Gaza Strip. And this occurred on the holy day, the religious Jews called by two names, Simchat Torah, which means rejoicing in the law, and they also call it Shemini Atzeret, which means the eighth day of the assembly, and what we call in the Church of God, the last great day. Over 1,300 Israelis had been killed with horrific accounts of unspeakable savagery. Israel is responding with constant bombings of Gaza, with over 2,000 Palestinians dead from those bombings. So Israel began a siege on the Gaza Strip, which just has over 2 million residents in less space than the area of the city of Chicago. So it's a piece of land about 25 miles long and 3.5 to 7.5 miles wide. Now, these responses by Israel will have ramifications as new images of the extreme suffering of the Palestinian families begin to show up, as they already have, on our social media and news sources. In terms of deaths, this conflict is the worst since 1973, which is called the Fourth Arab and Israeli War, and also known as the Yom Kippur War by the Israelis. In that war, the casualties were mostly soldiers. In this war, so far, the conflict has been mostly civilians. We can see from this event how quickly the world events can change in just hours. At the heart of the conflict is the land of what we've called in recent history called Palestine, and is now called the State of Israel. Personally, I've lived in Amman, Jordan for almost a year. I've visited Israel and Jerusalem, the Temple Mount, and I have visited a Palestinian refugee camp. And the emotions run very, very deep regarding the land. At the heart of the land is the city of Jerusalem. Jerusalem is important to three of the major monotheist religions of the world: Judaism, Christianity, and the Islamic faith. Close to 4 billion people, that is, that are all in those three categories, or over 50% of the world's population, consider and put a high, high spiritual and religious importance on Jerusalem. The Bible records that Jerusalem will be a focal point of tensions for all the nations. The prophet Zechariah writes of Jerusalem as being the center of a world conflict yet to come. If you want to turn there, and I used this verse last night in my message, but I want to use it again, Zechariah 12, if you want to turn there. Here's what Zechariah the prophet recorded about Jerusalem. And he writes, Zechariah 12, verse 1, "The burden of the word of the Lord against Israel. Thus says the Lord, who stretches out the heavens, lays the foundation of the earth, and forms the spirit of man within him." So God, who's made everything, charge of everything, all the land, universe, and man, and the spirit of man, he puts into him. Verse 2, "Behold, I will make Jerusalem a cup of drunkenness to all the surrounding peoples. When they lay siege against Judah and Jerusalem, and it shall happen in that day that I will make Jerusalem a very heavy stone for all peoples. All would heave it away will surely be cut in pieces, though all the nations of the earth are gathered against it." So we see a time here prophesied called in that day, so in a day, which always refers to the time when Christ returns, the final days when that happens, when Jerusalem is at the center of the worldwide conflict. Jerusalem is referred to as a heavy stone for all peoples, a heavy stone, not just for some groups, but all people. And we see a time when it is though the world is weighted down by this stone, or by Jerusalem, and it's like a heavy stone that they just can't move out of the way to make things better or to move forward. It's just there, and if they try to lift it or move it, it becomes too heavy for them, and anyone who tries to remove it or gets involved, or in this case, you know, it says they get cut or there's injuries. So it's very difficult. All the nations focus on removing what seems to be the cause of trouble, and it's likened to a heavy stone not able to be removed. Jerusalem means city of peace, yet it has rarely been a city of peace or a place of peace. Jerusalem is a focal point that invokes strong emotions among many of the billions of people we see, billions of people, and we see scripture itself foretelling of a time when all the nations and peoples are drawn into Jerusalem or drawn against Jerusalem. Jesus himself said in Luke 21:20, when you see Jerusalem being surrounded by armies, you will know that the desolation is near. So even Jesus Christ pointed to a future time, and certainly there could be a fulfillment of that in 70 AD, but when you read it, he's pointing to a final fulfillment. And he says, when you see Jerusalem being surrounded by armies, you know that the desolation is near. And we also read about many wonderful prophecies about Jerusalem reflecting what that name means. As Jerusalem is the most important city in the Bible, and what is occurring today in that area is a timely topic to review. So the title today of the sermon is Jerusalem, Yesterday, Today, and Forever. Jerusalem, Yesterday, Today, and Forever. Now, in the time we have for the message, we will need to be very selective on what we cover, as this could be a college course to cover this subject, maybe multiple college courses, but we will cover the key events of what has happened in the past and what has occurred to get us to the present situation and what the Bible says will occur in the future. So the purpose of the message is that we have a good overview and understanding of the history of Jerusalem, the events in recent history that contribute to the tensions in Jerusalem and the surrounding areas, and the future prophecies of Jerusalem, which point to a much, much different situation than what we see today. So before we begin, let's look at the names used for Jerusalem or connected to Jerusalem from the Bible. We have Salem, which means peaceful or safe. We see that. We'll read that in a moment. Mount Moriah. And that's the location where God told Abraham to take Isaac, and thought to be the same location where the Holy of Holies was located in the temple that Solomon built or located. We also have the word Jebus. And for a short time, Jerusalem was known as Jebus, the Jebusites. Part of the Canaanite clan lived in Jebus during Joshua's time and up to David's time. We have Zion or Mount Zion, which is symbolic of Jerusalem and the fortress area near the temple, near the Temple Mount, and also was known as the city of David. And we also have a term which we see in Isaiah 29, Ariel. Ariel is another name which refers to Jerusalem. And means lioness of El, or a symbolic name for Jerusalem. And we have, of course, Jerusalem, which means city of peace, city of peace. And we also have a future name, a future name. Isaiah 62:2 and Revelation 3:12 are scriptures that indicate that Jerusalem will have one day a new name, which we're not aware of. We're not told what it is. And we actually told in Revelation 3:12 that those that overcome will have, in the Church of Philadelphia, will have the new name written on them. So there is a new name, the new name of Jerusalem written on them. So Isaiah 62:2 and Revelation 3:12 are two scriptures that indicate a brand new name for Jerusalem. So Jerusalem, possibly more than any other city, has been torn down, captured, burned, rebuilt, torn down and rebuilt, and whatever else destructive you might want to use about Jerusalem. The city has been under the control of a wide variety of different nations, peoples, and religions. We have, very beginning, we have Melchizedek, the high priest and king of righteousness. We have Jerusalem being under the Canaanite control. We have Jerusalem being under King David and King Solomon and the kings of Judea. We have Jerusalem being under the Babylonian control, under Persian control, under the Hellenistic Greek control, Jewish control again, Egyptian control, Roman rule, Arabic rule, European Christian Crusaders control, and the Ottoman Empire control, and British control. One graph that I found showed 32 different groups or nations who ruled over Jerusalem. The Babylonians decimated Jerusalem and the temple near under King Nebuchadnezzar in 587-586. The Romans again decimated Jerusalem and the temple in 70 AD. And in 135 AD, Rome, yet again, due to a Jewish uprising, decimated Jerusalem again and barred all the Jews from coming back to Jerusalem. So Jerusalem has been has a most fascinating history and even more incredible future. So with this introduction, let's focus on some of the key past historical events about Jerusalem from the Bible. Then we'll cover key contributing events that fuel the current ongoing conflict in Jerusalem and the surrounding areas of Palestine and Judea area. Then the third section will focus on the amazing future of Jerusalem. So let's look at Jerusalem yesterday or in the past. Let's first look at, we'll see an individual, Melchizedek. The name was Salem, was the name of the city in Melchizedek. And so we'll go back about 1900 years ago, about 1900 BC, and the time of Abraham. Abram and his wife Sarai and his household lived in Ur, in the area of Mesopotamia. In Genesis 12, God tells Abram to get out of his country, from his family and from his father's house, and God said he would make him a great nation. And based on faith in God, he believed, Abram departed, and simply says that. He got up and left. When Abram went to the land of Canaan with his nephew Lot got into some trouble, and his family was taken captive by some of the attacking kings in the area. And Abram rescues Lot and in the process brings back a bounty of goods that Abram then ties to Melchizedek. So here we see the first reference to Jerusalem, at least by name. Genesis 14, 18, if you want to turn there and mark this up or note it. Genesis 14, 18, we have this account recorded for us. It says, then Melchizedek, king of Salem, brought out bread and wine. He was a priest of the God Most High, and he blessed him and said, blessed be Abram of God Most High, possessor of heaven and earth, and blessed be God Most High, who has delivered your enemies into your hand, and he gave him a tithe of all. So here we see the original name from the Bible of Salem, meaning peace. Well, who was Melchizedek? Well, the Apostle Paul tells us in Hebrews 7. In Hebrews 7, verse 1, and you're welcome to turn there if you want, or I can read it to you. Paul writes in Hebrews, who we believe wrote Hebrews, traditionally wrote Hebrews, said, for this Melchizedek, king of Salem, priest of the Most High God, who met Abraham returning from the slaughter of the kings and blessed him, to whom also Abraham gave a tenth part of all, first being translated king of righteousness, and then also king of Salem, meaning king of peace, without father, without mother, without genealogy, having neither beginning of days nor end of life, but made like the Son of God, remains a priest continually. So we see here Melchizedek, both king and priest of Salem. Paul tells us his name means king of righteousness, without father, without mother, without genealogy, having neither beginning of days nor end of life. King and priest of Salem. This can only be the member of the Godhead who became Jesus Christ. We see for a brief period in Abraham's life, knowing the king of Salem, and Abraham being obedient to God and giving tithes to Melchizedek. So that's the first instance of seeing Jerusalem in Scripture. Now we can go to another reference, Mount Moriah. Mount Moriah. Now we see a connection here to Jerusalem, but by a different name of Mount Moriah. And you can turn to Genesis 22:1 for that. Genesis 22:1 says, sometime later, God tested Abraham, and he said to him, Abraham. And he goes, here I am. It's amazing. All the faithful servants of God, when they were called on by God, say, here I am. It's a wonderful way to respond. Here I am, he replied. And then God, in verse 2, says, take your son, your only son, whom you love, Isaac, and go to the region of Moriah, sacrifice him there as a burnt offering on a mountain. I will show you. So of course we know God stepped in and stopped this from happening, but it foreshadows the future willing sacrifice of Jesus, the Son of God. Now, how do we know that Mount Moriah is associated with Jerusalem? Well, if we turn to 2 Chronicles 3:1, we're told that. 2 Chronicles 3:1, and you can mark this down, but I can read it to you. It says, now Solomon began to build the house of the Lord at Jerusalem on Mount Moriah, where the Lord had appeared to his father David at the place that David had prepared on the threshing floor of Ornan the Jebusite. So here we see Solomon building a temple to the Lord, to God, at the same location that God told Abraham to go, and it's to sacrifice his own son, Isaac. And we see the temple being built there, Mount Moriah. Now, let's move forward about 500 years to Joshua and the Israelites entering into the Promised Land. And we'll see a particular city and people that are defeated. But Israel seems unable to occupy the city for 400 years until King David captures the city. So here we have Joshua and the Jebusites. If you want to turn to Joshua 10:1, and we see this king, who's the king of Jerusalem. And remember, Joshua is going in to the Promised Land and that God is giving them. And they're to remove the people there, the Canaanites. Well, Joshua 10:1 tells us an interesting situation. Now, Adonai Zedek, king of Jerusalem, so here we have the term Jerusalem, heard that Joshua had taken Ai and totally destroyed it, doing in Ai and its king as he had done to Jericho and its king, and made the people of Gibeon had made a treaty of peace with Israel and become their allies. So here we already see geopolitics taking place. And the king of Jerusalem, Adonai Zedek, was not happy that these other group of people, the Gibeonites, had tricked Israel into making a peace treaty with them. And he and his people were very much alarmed at this because Gibeon was an important city, like one of the royal cities. It was much larger than Ai, and all its men were good fighters. So Adonai Zedek, king of Jerusalem, appealed to Hoham, king of Hebron, Piram, king of Jarmuth, Japhia, king of Lachish, and Debir, king of Eglon. Come up and help me attack Gibeon, he said, because it has made peace with Joshua and the Israelites. So we can go on and read the rest of the story, but Joshua defeats these kings, including the king of Jerusalem. But he did not capture the city of Jerusalem. So what made Jerusalem a very difficult city to capture? And it wasn't really till King David did Jerusalem really come under control of Israel, the kingdom of Israel, in the Promised Land. So it's sort of like the city Jerusalem could have stood by itself The people may have gone out to battle, lost battles with Israel, but the city itself seemed to be something that's very difficult for the Israelites to capture and keep. Well, for those who have been to Israel, and we have a few that have been there recently and into Jerusalem, they can tell you, or you can study maps, but the elevation of Jerusalem is about 2,500 feet up in the air. And think about this, though. You know, 2,500 feet in an area that's got plains, but just off to the east, we have the Dead Sea. And it's about 2 hours driving, about 90 kilometers. What's 1,400 feet below sea level? So it kind of has this perspective of going, of Jerusalem being up on a high mountain. And if you read the Bible, especially Acts, we're going through Acts right now, it always says that we're going up to Jerusalem. It doesn't matter from what direction we're going up to Jerusalem, because that's what you do, you go up. And this gives Jerusalem a very high elevated perspective. And Jerusalem was a walled city and had three valleys surrounding it, and making it very difficult for Joshua and others to conquer. And what also made it very difficult to conquer this city for Joshua is that it had access to water. Jerusalem had could withstand a very long siege, you know, because one of the things you do when you siege a city is you stop everything going in and out, including water and food. And if you don't have water, it isn't too long before things get very, very dire for the city, and they usually surrender. Well, Jerusalem could withstand very long sieges because they had access to the water, to water from within the city. And later on, we actually read of Hezekiah's tunnel, much later on, building another source of to a water supply. So they were, if you remember that story, they were withstanding the Syrians. The Syrians were going to take Hezekiah and Jerusalem, but they had access to water. And maybe they did it today. I don't know if the group did it this last year, but you know, I've gone through Hezekiah's tunnel, and it's a masterpiece that he built to have access to water. So Jerusalem has always had access to water. It made it very difficult to conquer and put a siege around. The Assyrians, the Babylonians, and the Romans had very long sieges of Jerusalem, and it was not an easy task for the Babylonians nor the Romans. So they were successful, but it wasn't an easy task. Later on, those who lived in Jerusalem maintained confidence because the temple was also in Jerusalem. The Israelites, or the Jews, had a lot of confidence in Jerusalem because the temple was there. They had this nice walled city, hard to conquer. It was surrounded by valleys. So very hard to conquer and it's hard to capture. And we'll even see this confidence in the location expressed to King David by the Jebusites, who are kind of taunting him. And we'll see how they taunt him in a moment. But let's go to Joshua 15:8 for right now, and we'll see that the tribe of Judah's border went up to Jerusalem at this time, but it didn't include Jerusalem. Joshua 15:8 says, and the border, and it's talking about the tribe of Judah and what land it got, and the border, referring to Judah again, went up by the valley of the son of Hinnom to the southern slope of the Jebusite city, which is Jerusalem. So at this point, it's sort of like this Jerusalem kind of stood by itself in the land of that God had given Israel and not ultimately conquered. So we'll move past Joshua, and we'll go into the time of Judges. And we see the tribe of Judah still battling to take Jerusalem. So Judges 1:8, it says, now the children of Judah fought against Jerusalem and took it. They struck it with the edge of the sword and set the city on fire. So here, we don't have a lot of detail, but it appears they took the city, but they left to keep on fighting other enemies, which is they did. And then the Jebusites, who were still living there, returned to inhabit Jerusalem. So they didn't really get rid of the Jebusites, ultimately, and get back in the city. And we'll see this in a moment. We'll move forward to the time of King David. So we'll move forward about 300 or 400 years forward to King David's time. The tribe of Judah, the king from the tribe of Judah, and David's interaction with Jerusalem and the Jebusites. So here we have David and the Jebusites. If you want to turn to 2 Samuel 5, and we'll read verse 1 through 10. And we'll see David and his interaction with the Jebusites who were residing in Jerusalem. And we have an interesting account here. It says, "Then all the tribes of Israel came to David at Hebron and spoke, saying, 'Indeed, we are your bone and your flesh. Also in time past when Saul was king over us, you were the one who led Israel out and brought them in. And the Lord said to you, you shall shepherd my people Israel and be ruler over Israel.' Therefore, all the elders of Israel came to the king at Hebron, and King David made a covenant with them in Hebron before the Lord. And they anointed David king over Israel." So we have this little insert here. Remember, King David was from Judah, and it took some time before all the tribes recognized him as king, and they're making this agreement to recognize King as David as king over all Israel, and he's in Hebron. Now it says in verse 4, "David was 30 years old when he began to reign, and he reigned 40 years. In Hebron he reigned over Judah 7 years and 6 months, and in Jerusalem he reigned 33 years over all Israel and Judah." So it kind of gives us this little preface to what we're about to see next. How did Jerusalem become the capital, you might say, of Jerusalem and where David decided to reside and make the capital over all Israel? Well, verse 6, we have the story here. "And the king and his men went to Jerusalem against the Jebusites." So here's the Jebusites still there, the inhabitants of the land, who spoke to David saying, "You should not come in here, but the blind and the lame will repel you." So here we have a taunt. He's saying, you know, we can just have blind people and people who don't have the full ability to use their bodies to sit there, and you can't even get past them because how confident we are. They're taunting him, thinking David cannot come in here. So that's how confident they are in Jerusalem and the walled city and how hard it was to get up there. Verse 7, "Nevertheless, David took the stronghold of Zion," that is the city of David. So here, we see the Jebusites very confident. They insulted David. They're giving him taunts. And in verse 8, we see how David took Jerusalem. Verse 8, "Now David said on that day, 'Whoever climbs up by way of the water shaft and defeats the Jebusites, the lame and the blind, who are hated by David's soul.'" So what does that mean? Well, David doesn't really hate the blind and the lame, but he's providing his own sort of taunt back to the Jebusites, a sort of his own kind of response to what they told him. And he goes on, and David goes on and says, "He shall be chief and captain." So whoever can go up to this water shaft, and David must have known it was there, and that was their kind of weak spot, he goes in there, he's going to give him a reward. "He shall be chief and captain. Therefore they say, 'The blind and the lame shall not come into the house.' Then David dwelt in the stronghold and called it the city of David, and David built all around from the Milo and inward. So David went on and became great, and the Lord God of hosts was with him." So here we see how King David finally captures Jerusalem, and he makes it the capital, and moving from Hebron to Jerusalem. And then we also know that Solomon built the temple there, and Jerusalem under King Hezekiah withstood the Assyrians with God's intervention. And ultimately, though, due to the ongoing, and we're skipping a lot of history here, but due to the ongoing abominations in Jerusalem, and if you ever want to see what God saw, you can just go to Ezekiel, and he kind of showed Ezekiel, here's what's going on in the temple. But due to the ongoing abominations, very bad things that were going on in Jerusalem, God allowed the Babylonians to capture Jerusalem and remove the Jews from the land. The Babylonian destruction the fall of Nebuchadnezzar fully destroyed it and took, you know, just removed everything from the temple. And you can read about that in 2 Chronicles 36:19, of the Babylonians' destruction of Solomon's temple under Nebuchadnezzar. Now, about 70 years later, we read in Ezra 1:1, you can see that there's a prophecy that after 70 years, that King Cyrus, who Isaiah names by name, you know, a prophecy that Isaiah would allow the Jews to come back and rebuild the temple. And how did Cyrus know that? Well, you can turn to Daniel 1, and it says Daniel was alive up until the first year of Cyrus. So Daniel most likely said, hey, Cyrus, this is what it says about you. And he was favorable towards the Jews and allowed them to go back. And it's a prophecy of what Cyrus would do. And he fulfilled that. So under Ezra and Nehemiah, the temple and Jerusalem was rebuilt. And during the time between Ezra and Nehemiah, to the time of Jesus Christ, Jerusalem was under the Persians, the Greeks, and Romans, and for a short time of independence under the Maccabees. So that's a lot of history right there. This brings us to the time of Jesus under Herod. And specifically the temple area, and Herod was specifically, you know, Ezra came back and built the temple up. Nehemiah helped build the walls up around Jerusalem. And the temple was nothing close to Solomon's temple in grandeur and magnificence. Well, Herod built up the Temple Mount and spent years and years just making a very beautiful temple, the surrounding areas, building up the Temple Mount and making it much better. So Jesus, let's go now to Jesus Christ and Jerusalem. In the time of Christ, we see Jesus himself and his love for Jerusalem. And we also see his sorrow for what was to come to Jerusalem. You know, remember, he, based on what we know in Hebrews, he was Melchizedek, living in Salem at the very beginning. And there's something special about Jerusalem, and he feels for what is going to happen. In Luke 19, verse 41, Jesus Christ is about to go into Jerusalem, and not too far off his last Passover with his disciples before he's killed. It says, now as he drew near, that's Jesus Christ, he saw the city and wept over it. You can see him kind of going into the city. And for those who have entered the city of Jerusalem, it's a magnificent, it can bring tears to your eyes if you're coming in to the city a certain way and seeing the Temple Mount. And I can only imagine seeing the temple at Herod's time, well, the temple that Herod built up, and how magnificent it was and what it meant to the Jews, and especially Jesus Christ. And he saw the city and wept over it, saying, if you had known, even you, especially in your day, the things that make for your peace, but now they are hidden from your eyes. So he wept because he knew that peace was not going to come to Jerusalem. And the Romans, as he prophesied, did destroy Jerusalem in 70 AD. And he said, not one stone will be left. And that's an interesting story of how that occurs. Well, there's so much gold on the that was put on the temple that, and they set it on fire. Well, all the gold melted. And of course, people are always interested in getting gold. So they were just motivated, the Romans and anybody else that had an opportunity to do it, to remove the rocks, move things out of the way to get to the gold, because all the gold kind of sunk down to the bottom. And so every stone was truly removed. What you see today at the Temple Mount, the Wailing Wall is really is not part of the temple. It's just a wall that Herod put up to build up the space for the Temple Mount. So every stone was removed, as Christ said. All the gold, and the temple was put on fire by accident. It wasn't intentional, but caught on fire, and all the gold and all those things melted. And because of that, there was motivation to remove every stone, and that's what the Romans did. All right, now let's move forward some 1,800 years. Now, we're skipping a lot of history, I know that, but we'll go forward 1,800 years. We're skipping a lot of history about Jerusalem, but let's now spend some time on Jerusalem today and understand the key aspects that contribute to what we see today. How did that area, Palestine, Jerusalem, the Gaza Strip, how come there's so much tension, so much animosity, so much deep emotions? How did they get there? How did we get there? How did the world get to this point and see all these tensions that we see in the news? Many will look at this as a very complex subject, and it is. But let me give you three broad events that help us understand Jerusalem and Israel today, and the intense feelings many have on this topic. And the three things I want to focus on is Zionism, the British Mandate, and UN Resolution 181. So three things that all contribute greatly to what we see today. Again, this section could be an entire college class, maybe more, to cover this fully and properly and in detail. So I'm going to not be able to cover this in detail, but I'm going to highlight these three significant factors that underpin the hostilities we see playing out, not just in Jerusalem, but around the world. So let's begin with Zionism. What is Zionism? And what were the underlying reasons for the idea of Zionism coming about? Well, first of all, we should understand Zionism could not have come about except for the Jewish diaspora. And what's diaspora? Well, that means the dispersion of or the spread of people from their original homeland. And the Jewish diaspora, or the removal of the Jews from Judea and Jerusalem and the surrounding areas, started with Nebuchadnezzar, as he began to deport Jews from the land of Judea and from the area of southern Judea. Some of the well-known individuals deported are people that we know, Daniel and his three friends, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. And Nebuchadnezzar in 587, 586 BC had this final siege and destruction of Jerusalem, and the temple was destroyed, and he removed most of the Jewish population and moved them and deported them into Mesopotamia and Babylonian areas. Now, 70 years passed, and Cyrus, who was prophesied by Isaiah, as we mentioned, allowed the Jews to return back to the area, led by Ezra, and to rebuild the temple. But what we may overlook is that only a very small part of the Jews returned back to Jerusalem. An estimated 50,000 only went. All the rest remained. So far, only a very small portion of the Jews went back to that area to rebuild the temple. All right, so that's one reason. So the idea there is that we have Jews all in this area of Babylon, still staying there. So they're still in the area, but they're staying true to their culture and religion in many ways. Skip forward to the Greek and Roman times. Many Jews had moved throughout the Roman Empire and into Rome itself. One estimate was that 100,000 Jews lived in Rome, of a city of about 1 million, so about one-tenth. One estimate is about one-tenth of the population of Rome were Jews living there. And upwards to 10 million Jews in the entire Roman Empire, all spread out, mostly in urban areas in the Roman Empire. So we have a lot of Jews not in Jerusalem. And in 70 AD, there are Jews that came back and the population grew back in Jerusalem. Well, in 70 AD, due to the Jews rebelling against Rome, because they always had this idea that that they could retake and have independence in Jerusalem back. So they would constantly rebel. And they had a big rebellion in 70 AD, which did not go well. The Roman armies came in under Titus and destroyed Jerusalem, and again, removed all the Jews from the area, moved them back out and put them in different places around the empire. All right, so we have, again, Jews back in, not in Jerusalem. In 135 AD, again, the Jews had built up enough resistance again back in that area against Rome with hopes of rebuilding the temple. That's what they wanted to do. And the Emperor Hadrian, which you might know the name Hadrian, he had Hadrian's Wall in Great Britain to keep out the Scots from coming down. But he was the emperor, and he was getting really tired of the Jews. And he put down the revolt because they were rising up again, and had a very long time revolt, 3 or 4 years it took before he came in and just totally squashed the Jews' revolt, and he deported all the Jews from the area and forbid them from returning. So he had enough of this, and in the years following this revolt, the Emperor Hadrian discriminated against all the Judean Christian sects, but the worst persecution was directed against religious Jews. He made anti-religious decrees forbidding the Torah study, Sabbath observance, circumcision, Jewish courts, meeting in synagogues, and other ritual practices. So he tried to wipe out the Jewish religion and move everybody away. Now, just as a side note, due to the extreme anti-Jewish decrees, church historians mark this time as a key time is when Christianity moved to have a final separation from what is seen as Jewish observances and like the Sabbath and holy day. So that's a key date to remember. When, you know, remember the early church, they couldn't tell the difference between the new church, the church and the Jews, because they kept the holy days, the Sabbath. It was mostly made up of Jews that converted or were and baptized into the church. And as it became more Gentile oriented, and as the Roman Empire became very anti-Jewish because of the rebellions they would do, you could see in the minds of some of the Christians' leaders to separate themselves from being Jewish, and that's exactly what they did, and that's ultimately how we got to the Christian world, got away from Sabbath keeping and holy days and things like that. Maybe just a side point on that. But the result of the deportation of the Jews, they, you know, all this occurred, and they began to settle all through the Roman Empire into Europe and into Russia and even to Arabic countries. Now, due to the, and then during this time and over the years and over the decades, you know, there's a lot of time here, but there was not uncommon to have Jewish persecution in different European countries and in Russia. And as you can imagine, over time, the Jewish people would begin to think, well, wouldn't it be nice if we had our own country, our own place to live, but we'd stop being persecuted. Every time, it was a common practice that when something was going wrong, blame the Jews, and then they'd be persecuted. And that was a common practice, and if you might remember the movie Fiddler on the Roof, that's what it's all about in Russia, where the Tsar decided to that the Jews were responsible for something and had them move off and be persecuted. Well, this was not an uncommon practice. So out of this idea, out of this happening, came the idea of Zionism, the idea that Jews should have their own homeland. And this began to happen around the 1800s and the early 1900s. And so Zionism is simply establishing a homeland for the Jews in Palestine that reflect roughly the land of Israel in the days of King David. So about the time that Zionism is starting to kind of catch with Jews around the world, and there's a movement to support it, this is about the time that the Ottoman Empire controls the area of Palestine. And they had controlled it for a good 400 or 500 years. And it had been relatively a peaceful location or peaceful area to live. The majority of the population were Arabs, with a small population being Jewish. However, in 1917, that all changed when the Ottoman Empire sided with its German ally in World War I, and Germany lost the war, which means the losers had to give up things, pieces of land and things that they control, and the Ottoman Empire gave up the area of Palestine and other areas. And the particular area they gave up of Palestine came under control of Britain. So this is where things begin to get real messy. As promises were given to different groups, right? Because as you can imagine, World War I, and they're fighting, and then people are getting promises that if you support us, you'll get this and you'll get that. And different groups were getting different promises of what they'd get. So it gets really messy. I'm not going to get into all that, but let's move to the very next contributor. So we just covered Zionism and sort of roughly why it began to take hold and why it's popular and had some traction. The next contributor to what we see today is what is called the Balfour Declaration and the British Mandate. Balfour Declaration and the British Mandate. So as World War I was ending in 1917, or they're planning on the end of the war, Lord Arthur Balfour, a past Prime Minister of Great Britain, remember, Great Britain's a big power in the world, maybe the biggest power in the world at this time, and an influential politician, issued what is called the Balfour Declaration, which was a public statement issued by the British government in 1917, just before the World War I ended, announcing support for the establishment of a national home for the Jewish people in Palestine. Then, still at that point, though, it was still an Ottoman region with a small minority Jewish population. This declaration gave public support for Zionism. A major world power, you know, Great Britain, remember the empire where the sun never set. And here's a major politician, a past prime minister, someone very influential, declaring that the Jews should have their own homeland in Palestine. And ultimately, Britain became in control of Palestine after World War I. And so this became a very significant statement. Soon after World War I, the effect of the Balfour Declaration, which declared support for a home for the Jewish people alongside Palestinian Arabs, gained traction. So who do you think was not so happy about that? And people had their own promises given to them. Well, the Arabs and the Palestinian Arabs were not very happy with that. And this, of course, created tension as Jews began to migrate into Palestine. The Jewish population increased under British control, with both Palestinian Arabs and Jewish political groups forming. So at this point, you know, Jews begin to migrate into Palestine in great numbers, and this disrupts the balance that's there. Britain obviously has a hard time managing this, and political groups on both sides start to form to stop what's going on. But the Balfour Declaration and the British Mandate form the basis of United Nations approving what's called UN Resolution 181 in 1948 and the State of Israel. So UN Resolution 181, let's talk about that. After World War II, and as all the atrocities became known of what occurred against the Jews in Germany and Nazi Germany and all the massive 6 million Jews being killed in the Holocaust, there certainly became sympathy, if not an outcry, for the Jews to have their homeland. So Jews from around Europe and those who lived in different countries had been coming to Palestine, and now there was a support by the world powers, right? You know, which is really Great Britain, France, and the United States and the UN, and they supported having a Jewish homeland that would be in Palestine. So the UN passed what's called Resolution 181 in 1947, which proposed a partitioned Palestine at the end of the British Mandate in 1948. So Britain wanted out of there. It was getting to be a difficult thing to manage. So they wanted out of there, so this UN resolution would go in one day after the British Mandate ended, allowing the Britain to leave. And the idea was that there would be an independent Arab state and an independent Jewish state. That was the idea. And the UN passed this. Now, of course, this is, to understand what's going on here, think about for those who have siblings. And you have your one piece of cake, and your mom tells you you have to share it. Well, what did my parents do? It's like whoever cuts it, the other person gets to choose, right? And that way it gets cut very even, and whoever, so if you're told, okay, you gotta split it, and whoever cuts it, make sure it's very even. Trust me, we've done this with my siblings. It's about as close as you can get to even. Well, that's not what happened. the UN passed this resolution, and the Arab countries didn't like the resolution. Well, why? Well, 62% of the land was allocated to the Jewish state, even though the Palestinian Arab population was twice the number of Jews living in Palestine. So you can put yourself in their shoes and like, well, that doesn't seem fair. Or it's like the person who gets to cut the cake gets to choose the first piece. You know, that's not fair. And if you get to choose the first piece, you know, you're going to make it big for you and maybe a little smaller for the other person. So there was a lot of dissatisfaction for those Arabs living in the Palestinian area, as they seemed to have no real voice in the matter, and there wasn't any self-determination. You know, they were just there, and nobody asked them, or they didn't really have a vote on the matter. So on May 14th, 1948, one day before the British mandate ended, David Ben-Gurion declares the establishment of the Jewish state. So what happens next? Well, the next day, four Arab countries entered into Palestine, and the 1948 Arab-Israeli War started, with Arab nations' intention not to allow a Jewish state to take hold or form. Well, this war went on for a year before a ceasefire. But what happened in this time period is over 700,000 Palestinians are estimated to have left the area they had lived in for hundreds of years. And this is really the deep, deep emotions that the Palestinians feel. And I, as I said, I went to a Palestinian camp a long time ago, and they're still there telling you about land they could see over the valley that was theirs, with the trees and the orange trees that were growing there, and they viewed it as land that was theirs. That's not theirs anymore. And there's deep emotions. So what continues to go on, right? So we're talking about this mandate, this 1948 UN Resolution 181, and they have this war, which did not go well for the Arabs. And as World War II was only less than 5 years away from this point, it was 1948, so we're less than 3 years from this point in time. A year goes by, they're fighting. Well, there's still a large number of Israeli Jewish Holocaust survivors and Jews that live in Arab states. And what do they want to do? Well, of course, they want to move to the Jewish homeland, their state. So over 1 million Jews migrated to Israel in this time. And this began to cause the Palestinian resistant groups to form. And several wars, I'm skipping a lot of information here, but a lot of several wars occurred since that 1948 first war, 67 and 73 wars. And in those wars, Israel captured more land, such as the West Bank, and the Golan Heights, and the Sinai Peninsula. Now, they ultimately gave the Sinai Peninsula back to Egypt, but you know, they now have this land, and people are coming in, Jews are coming in, and they begin settling in these areas, the West Bank and the Golan Heights. So, as a whole, there's been some progress in the relationship between Israel and the Arab neighbors, but there's always been this segment or portion within the Palestinians with long-term memories of lost land, and they continue to want to fight for what they see was taken from them. A lot of emotions there, a lot of emotions. It's a very complex situation, and I skipped over lots, trust me, I trusted over lots, but I hope this helps understand some of the key elements that led to what we see today, the extreme emotions of two groups and the animosity and the even hatred and things that built up over years and years and years between these two groups. Now, we see from Scripture the stone. Remember, we talked about this heavy stone. The stone continues to get heavier, and the emotions, hurts, and anger will only increase. That's what's in prophecy. It only gets worse. It's not done to get better. But let's look forward to this section of Jerusalem forever, the future of Jerusalem. And show that there is a very positive, fantastic, what we might say, eternal future, where Jerusalem is the center of peace and God's law being coming out of Jerusalem in the millennium, and where Christ will come back and reside, and the new Jerusalem, where God the Father will return and dwell with his family. Incredible statements being made about Jerusalem. Let's go to Zechariah 14. And we'll see this being stated. So we're in the section now of Jerusalem forever. Zechariah 14 foretells Christ's return to fight against those nations that want to battle against Jerusalem. Let's look at some parts of the chapter 14. I won't read the whole thing, but it's quite a long chapter. And it's not really a pleasant outcome for those who fight against Jerusalem. But the very, very good news we see, the change of heart, a change of direction of the enemies of Jerusalem, and they ultimately begin to keep God's holy days. Verse 3, let's go to Zechariah 14, verse 3. It says, then the Lord will go forth and fight against those nations as he fights in the battle in the day of battle, and in that day his feet will stand on the Mount of Olives, which faces Jerusalem on the east, and the Mount of Olives shall be split in two, from east to west, making a very large valley. Half of the mountain shall move toward the north, the other half towards the south. Then you shall flee through my mountain valley, and the mountain valley shall reach to Azal. Yes, you shall flee as you fled from the earthquake in the days of Uzziah, king of Judah. Thus the Lord my God will come and all the saints with you. So here we see a prophecy of Christ coming back to the Mount of Olives, just in the Mount of Olives, just east of Jerusalem. And for those who have been there, you can just go to the Mount of Olives and just look over and see into the Temple Mount. I'm not sure they did that on the tour, but it's a wonderful view into the Temple Mount area. And it says this mountain will be split. And it indicates for the purpose of the fact that people in Jerusalem can escape. So it appears that there may be a siege, and the people can escape, they can leave in that way. There's now a way to get out. And we also see all the saints are with Jesus Christ. This verse 8, let's keep going. And in that day shall be that living water shall flow from Jerusalem, half of them towards the eastern sea, and half of them towards the western sea. In both summer and winter it shall occur. And the Lord shall be king over all the earth. In that day it shall be the Lord is one and his name one. So now we see Jerusalem, now with Christ in charge, that things begin to change for the good. Living waters are flowing both to the east and to the west seas. The eastern sea to the east is the Dead Sea. And if you've been to the Dead Sea, you can float in it. Nothing lives in it. It's called the Dead Sea for a reason. In fact, if you have a few gulps of water from the Dead Sea, you can do irreversible damage to yourself and even die. So it's called the Dead Sea for a reason. But we see that changes. Living waters going into it. And then we also see that the sea west of Jerusalem, which we assume is the Mediterranean area, living waters now flowing to that sea, repairing whatever damage may have been done to the Mediterranean waters. Verse 11 says, the people shall dwell in it, and talking about Jerusalem, and no longer shall there be utter destruction, but Jerusalem shall be safely inhabited. So here we see a time where it's safe to be in Jerusalem. There's peace. Verse 16, and it shall come to pass that everyone who is left of all the nations, so based on what we know from other prophecies and Revelation, there are some massive battles. A lot of people, unfortunately, fight against Christ. But everyone who is left of all the nations which come against Jerusalem shall go up from year to worship the King, the Lord of hosts, and to keep the Feast of Tabernacles. So we see a very different time. This is the millennial time in Jerusalem where God's law begins to go out from Jerusalem and things change. Over 1,000 years, things get very good, but it all comes from Jerusalem where Jesus Christ is located. Jeremiah 3:17, let me read this to you. Jeremiah 3:17 says this, at that time Jerusalem shall be called the throne of God, and all the nations shall be gathered to it, to the name of the Lord, to Jerusalem. No more shall they follow the dictates of their evil hearts. So we see a time where it's very different. The things we see today, the things we will see, change. It's a positive environment, and no more evil hearts, it says. They do not follow the dictates of their evil hearts. So again, more millennial peace from Christ's governance. And this is all through the book of Isaiah. So if you want to read a lot of positive things about what's going to happen in the millennium, the law going out, peace, prosperity, justice coming out from Jerusalem, all through the book of Isaiah. You know, and I don't really have an answer to what's going to happen to, all I know is God is the God of justice. He will make things right. So however people think, he's going to make things right for them. And we'll see how that works out, but we know God is the God of justice, and everybody will get their fair situation. But we see Christ, the King, his comfort is over the area. Let's go to Isaiah 40, verse 9. It says, Isaiah verse, chapter 40, verse 9, says, you who bring good news to Zion, again, Zion is one of the terms for Jerusalem, go up to a high mountain. You who bring good news to Jerusalem, lift up your voice and shout. Lift up, do not be afraid. Say to the towns of Judah, here is your God. So amazing, you know, such a future thing. Here is your God going to all the areas of Judea. See the sovereign Lord comes with power and he rules with a mighty arm. See his reward is with them and his recompense accompanies him. And this, look at verse 11. He tends his flock like a shepherd. He gathers the lambs in his arms and carries them close to his heart. He gently leads those that have young. So a very different situation. Christ views a shepherd, very gently helping people, comforting them. Well, there's much more we could cover on the peace to come to the whole world from Jerusalem as Christ is the king, and that's his throne, and where his throne is, and how he begins to rule the earth in peace through God's laws being established, and how prosperity and justice begin to take reign begin to take hold in the world. Hopefully you heard about that at the feast. But let's jump forward now. Let's go again. Let's keep going forward beyond the millennium. Beyond the millennium. Revelation 21, verse 2. Revelation 21, verse 2. Here's John, who was shown a vision, the revelation of Christ, really of God the Father, by Christ to John. It says, Revelation 21, verse 2, says, then I, John, saw the holy city, New Jerusalem, coming down out of heaven from God, prepared as a bride adorned for her husband. And I heard a loud voice from heaven saying, behold, the tabernacle of God is with men, and he will dwell with them, and they shall be his people. God himself will be with them and be their God. And God will wipe away every tear from their eyes. There shall be no more death, nor sorrow, nor crying. There shall be no more pain, for the former things have passed away. So here we see a time, a future time, that we place beyond the 1,000-year millennium, a new Jerusalem, God dwelling with his creation, with his people as children, a time when all the hurts and pain are removed, and even God, like a father, pictured wiping away the tears from his children and removing the hurt. Let's look in more detail about this new Jerusalem. Revelation 21, if you want to turn the next page over in your Bible, Revelation 21, 10, we see more visions of a new Jerusalem. In verse 10, he says, and he carried me away in the spirit to a great and high mountain and showed me the great city, the holy Jerusalem, descending out of heaven from God, having the glory of God. Her light was like the most precious stone, like a jasper stone, clear as crystal. Also, she had a great and high wall with 12 gates and 12 angels at the gates and names written on them, which are the names of the 12 tribes of the children of Israel, 3 gates on the east, 3 gates on the north, 3 gates on the south, and 3 gates on the west. Now the wall of the city had 12 foundations, and on them were the names of the 12 apostles of the Lamb. And he who talked with me had a gold reed to measure the city, its gates, and its wall. The city is laid out as a square, its length as great as its breadth, and he measured the city with a reed. 12,000 furlongs, its length, breadth, and height are equal. Then he measured its wall, 144 cubits, according to the measure of the man, that is, of an angel. The construction of its wall was of jasper, and the city was pure gold, like clear glass. The foundations of the wall of the city were adorned with all kinds of precious stones. The first foundation was jasper, the second sapphire, the third chalcedony, the fourth emerald, and the fifth sardonyx, the sixth sardis, the seventh crystallite, and the eighth beryl, the ninth topaz, the tenth chrysoprase, the 11th jacinth, and the 12th amethyst. The 12 gates were 12 pearls. Each individual gate was of one pearl, and the street of the city was pure gold, like transparent glass. Verse 22, and I saw no temple in it. saw no temple in it. Why? For the Lord God Almighty and the Lamb are its temple. Dwelling there. The city had no need for the sun or of the moon to shine in it, for the glory of God illuminated it. The Lamb is its light, and the nations of those who are saved shall walk in its light, and the kings of the earth bring their glory and honor into it. So here we see a Jerusalem that exceeds anything ever seen, far exceeds Solomon's temple, blows away whatever Herod may have done, far beyond that, in a time when all the nations shall walk in its light. God is there. Christ is there, meaning there is no need for a temple. We see an eternal Jerusalem, Jerusalem forever. As we see the tragedies we see in the news, and as we begin to witness them and see them, which we will, let's be comforted that things that we'll see and that will occur will not always be this way, but rather a glorious future pictured in the future Jerusalem.